Session number 12133, Colonel Terence Otway, Reel 1.
Can we start, please, with Normandy, and can you take me through step by step in detail what your own personal memories of your own participation in Normandy was, please?
Should we start with the period when we were informed that we were going to, when I was informed that we were going to take part, because the
Please,
training
yes.
is important.
Yes, please.
Right, I was on leave in, I forget, either March or April 1944, and I was recalled to take over command of the battalion and promoted to lieutenant colonel, as I had been second in command as a major. I was immediately told that the battalion was going to take part in the invasion of Europe, not Normandy, of Europe, and it would have to capture a battery. I was then taken by the brigade major, Bill Collingwood, who retired as a brigadier and is living near Plymouth, to a house near Amesbury, which was the 6th Airborne Divisional Planning House, and it was covered in, surrounded in barbed wire, and had sentries all round it, military police sentries, and I was locked in a top room and shown a model, a big model, of an area, not told where it was. Said, "That's the battery. Have a look at it and start thinking about how you will attack it." And this was at about 10:30 in the morning, and round about 11:30, sorry, about 12:30, it became urgent that I should go to the lavatory. And I banged on the door, and nothing happened, so I opened the window and let rip out through the window. And eventually, the door, I don't know if this is permissible in this tape, eventually I was released, and I had had a thought about it. And when I went out of the front door, there was a red-capped military policeman standing there with the top of his hat looking extremely damp, and he gave me a very dirty look. Apparently I'd hit him when I, through the window. Then I got hold of one of my officers, who was a Captain Gordon Brown, to assist me in the planning, and I made my plan. And my thinking was, it didn't seem to me sensible to fly over the Atlantic Wall and drop there, outside a battery, the defenses of which were very formidable indeed, because they were all there in the model and I was given them. And they going from the outside, they consisted of an electrified cattle fence, then a minefield, then what we in those days called a barbed wire apron fence, which consisted of rows of barbed wire slung on a central piece of wire so that they sloped down on either side, your side on the other side. And then there was another minefield and more wire. So I decided that, oh, sorry, and inside the garrison consisted of 150 men. We were told at the time that the guns were 150 millimeters and that they were sighted down to fire along the beaches over which the British troops would land by sea, 3rd British Division. I decided that we would attack the battery from the landward side, because that was nearest to the dropping zone, but we would, by hook or by crook, get some troops directly inside the battery, either dropping them by parachute or landing them by glider to take them by surprise. By this time, we had got to, say, the middle of April, or the second half of April, and I had been told exactly where the battery was in Normandy. I'd been told it was the Merville battery. And either then or shortly afterwards, I attended a briefing by Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery, of all commanding officers. I was not allowed to tell my officers at that time where we were going. I also decided at that time that we must practice this, because if you are making an ordinary infantry attack by night, in 9 cases out of 10, you do have the opportunity to go by daylight and have a look at the ground over which you're going to attack at night, the enemy ground. But in an airborne operation, you do not. You drop in at night, and you have got to get to your objective, and you may attack your objective at night, or you may attack it by daylight, but it doesn't matter. You are there at night in strange territory, and therefore every single soldier of whatever rank, major down to private soldier, must know exactly what he's doing, because otherwise they will get lost. They won't know where to go. So I decided that we had to train for this in very great detail. And I asked the brigade major to pick me out an area, and he flew over the ground, and he picked me out an area just southwest of Newbury, which was opposite of, it was near a little hamlet called Woodhay, W-W-O-D-H-A-Y, and it had the advantage that it was below an 800-foot hill, which was great for firing live ammunition, making it fairly safe. But it also had the disadvantage there were two hillocks in it. So I said to him, I must have that flattened, and he objected slightly, and I said, well, okay. So he got down a civil service from Whitehall who said impossible. So I said, look, do it. And to cut a long story short, we got through six or seven ministries within 24 hours. Earth-moving equipment was brought from Liverpool and Birkenhead. I don't know why they had to go so far for it. And in 48 hours, the place was flattened. We then built from the Royal Air Force reconnaissance photographs the complete route from the dropping zone in France through the French countryside to the Merville battery in replica in every detail, the footpaths we made, the ditches, the hedges we constructed, the stiles we constructed. We even put in anticipation of the RAF missing the target, which they did later, bomb holes. And we had 9 rehearsals, 4 by day, 5 by night, the last one with live ammunition. Then we went from that camp back to Bulford, collected our kit, and we went pretty well straight away to a transit camp at, and I can't remember, what was the name of the atomic energy place in Oxfordshire?
Harwell.
And we were sealed in that transit camp, and we shared it with the Royal Ulster Rifles, 1st Battalion of the Royal Ulster Rifles. And at that time, I then briefed all the officers and all the men, and each section was briefed with a set of photographs. Every section in the battalion was issued with a set of photographs, and the men were questioned and questioned and questioned as to what they had to do. There was an unfortunate accident which rather shook some people, in that a rather dud grenade, when I say dud, unstable grenade, went off in the Ulster Rifles when they were checking their ammunition and killed a couple of people, including an officer. And of course, as you know, we were all keyed up to go on the night of the 4th of June, because the original date of the invasion was the 5th and it was postponed 24 hours. That didn't have an effect on morale, really. It just gave them an extra night's sleep. I forbade drinking the night before the day we took off, and I myself went over and had a shower at the RAF place just to get away, and we went to the airfield about 9 o'clock, squirrel, and we took off from, I think, at about 10:30 p.m. and I walked down the aircraft and I spoke to all the aircrew and all the men, every one of them. There were about, I think, about 30. And before that, I'd been over to Bryce Norton, where the gliders were. Now, let me come back to the actual detailed plan. I went over there to talk to our men and the aircrews. I'm doing this deliberately so that the plan is right next door to the takeoff, if that's the right expression. My plan in outline was to drop, as I said earlier, as on the dropping zone side, and to attack at 4:30 a.m. and to have 3 glider loads of troops land inside the battery, stopping themselves by knocking their wings off the casements and taking the garrison entirely by surprise. And the last part of their journey would be lit up by mortar flares fired by us. I planned 4 attack parties for the casements, 1 for each casement, and therefore 4 gaps through the wire to be blown up by what were then called Bangalore torpedoes. And I had various two diversion parties, one to go to the main gate and kick up a hell of a row, and one to go to the left and kick up another hell of a row to divert the garrison. There was an anti-tank ditch on the seaward side of the battery. I presume they expected tanks to come in across the beach there. I wasn't sure whether that ditch would be extended round to our side, so I had special lightweight bridges made, and they were not delivered when we got to the transit camp, and I thought, oh dear. But luckily for me, there was a very great friend of mine called Lieutenant General Sir Jack Evarts, who was an ex-Ulster rifleman, who was the deputy chief of the Imperial General Staff, as it was there, and I rang him up, and they appeared the next day. I also took with me in gliders some anti-tank guns to blow down the rear steel doors, should they be shut, of the casements. There's no point in attacking a battery and trying to get through a shut steel door to blow the guns up. I also took Royal Engineers to blow the guns up, and I took what were called Anyway, they were sailors of the Royal Navy who were telegraphers, and they dropped with us because I was told that if we were not out of there and had not succeeded by 5 or 5:30 a.m., HMS Arethusa would bombard the battery, and these men dropped with us were to direct the fire. So that, in outline, is the plan, except that half an hour ahead of us, I sent in a plane load consisting of 3 officers. One officer was Major Parry, and his job was to mark out the dropping zone for us and the rendezvous at which there was a red flickering light, so that all the men who dropped then homed in on the rendezvous. And the other 2 officers were Major Smith, in charge of the reconnaissance party, and Captain the Honourable Paul Greenway, who later became Lord Greenway, and whose son is now Lord Greenway. And he was in charge of the taping party. Their jobs were, the reconnaissance party consisted of Major Smith and two warrant officers, and their job was to sit outside the Wa and listen to the Germans and pinpoint any sentries or anything they could hear. The taping party's job was to cut, short-circuit the cattle fence, cut it, and tape with mine detectors four paths through the mines in complete silence, so that we would reduce the risk of getting blown up on the minefields to the minimum. As I said, they all went in half an hour ahead of us. We took off on time. There was nothing very eventual about it. The Royal Ulster Rifles lined up the road going out of the camp, and as I said, I spoke to all the crews. We took off on time. It was a beautiful night, but I actually stood in the door of my aircraft when we flew over the Solent, and it was a most fantastic sight. It was bright enough to see quite a lot of detail. I could see all the ships in the Solent. They seemed to be in a ring round the Isle of Wight, and they seemed to be already streaming towards the French coast. And I stood there all the way, or most of the way, but I had taken a bottle of whiskey on board, as well as a flask of whiskey, my hip. So we all had a drink there, and I passed it round. And we arrived on time over the coast, and quite suddenly anti-aircraft fire, large and small, opened up on us. And I passed the whiskey to the RAF dispatcher. There wasn't much left in the bottle, but I told him he could have it. And I was waiting to jump, and there was an explosion. Now, there's a bit of controversy about this, because there was an explosion near the tail of the aircraft, and I was propelled, if you like, I'm not exactly blown, but I was ready to jump, but I went, followed by my batman. And the controversy is that some people have said that there was little anti-aircraft fire, and there wasn't a shell near the aircraft, but I don't imagine these things. And my batman, who was standing in the door behind me, didn't imagine it, and it was there. I actually saw a tracer coming up, and one or two tracer bullets actually went through my parachute. I realized when I was coming down that I was not going to drop on the dropping zone. I also realized it was extremely dangerous, because I saw a Stirling bomber, which was, we were in Dakota, C-47s, but there was a Stirling which had been used for, Stirlings and Lancasters were all, and Albemarles were used for dropping. Stirling passed under me, and I wondered whether I was going to hit it. So it was a rather dangerous situation, and completely chaotic, aircraft going in all directions, except the right ones, and all levels except the right ones. Anyway, I realized that I was not going to drop on the dropping zone. I realized, because of the very detailed briefing, that odds-on chances were that I was going to hit a building which I knew was either a German battalion or company headquarters. It contained German troops, and I did hit it. I hit it at first floor level. My shoulder was about the level of the windowsill, and then I dropped down to the ground. And somebody threw open the window and looked out, and I was fumbling around for something to throw at him, a grenade or something, but our grenades are not primed. And one of my corporals suddenly appeared from nowhere, and he picked up a brick or a rock or something and hurled it up at this man leaning out of the window, who vanished. And we then made our way down the drive, because I knew exactly where I was, and I was quite a long way from the dropping zone. And we went across the road and found that all the ground on the other side was flooded. We had to make our way away from the house, and we didn't go straight to the dropping zone, because if there were German troops there, we didn't want to lead them straight onto the dropping zone. We thought we might get away. And we met two rather stout German soldiers on bicycles. We stopped, and when we told them we were British troops, they said that they were rather sick and tired of the SS dressing up in British uniforms and doing exercises, and could they please get back to barracks? So we did convince them they were British troops. We took their rifles and threw them into the marshy water and told them to get on their bikes, literally, and get the hell out of it, which they did rather thankfully. I often wondered what happened to them. In the meantime, as I learnt later, my batman, Joe Wilson, who's still alive, had dropped through the greenhouse at the back of this building. He'd gone through the roof, and he came round to the front of the drive, and as he came round, he saw a German section doubling down the drive, so he fell in behind with his rifle at the high port, and they turned left and he turned right, and they never saw him. He went straight to the dropping, to the rendezvous, and got there ahead of me. I had to wade through water, sometimes up to my armpits, and I met the brigade headquarters staff captain, John Woodgate, and several other troops as well. We saw men who had dropped into the marshes, and we tried to pull them out, and we couldn't get them out because of the suction of the mud, their heavy kit bags, and several of them were drowned. It was rather horrible. However, I did arrive at about 1 o'clock, I think, at the rendezvous. It may have been earlier, a bit hazy, to be met by my batman, and this is, here I am not exaggerating, who said, shall we have our brandy now, sir? He was an ex-valet, and he literally held out to me a flask full of brandy, which he had taken. My flask full of whiskey had been smashed on landing. I found that out of the total of around 700 battalion group, that is to say, or 750, that is to say the 650 odd of the battalion, plus the artillerymen of the anti-tank guns, the medical men who dropped with us, the sailors, the engineers, I only had 100 of all ranks, including myself. And I didn't get in. At the time to move off, which was 2:15 a.m., I only had 100. I think I'm wrong in saying I only had 50 when I got to the rendezvous. But unbeknown to everybody else, I'd kept a quarter of an hour on the timing, up my sleeve, as a cushion. And in that time, another 50 came in. I was then faced with a decision. I'm supposed to attack this battery with a battalion of 600 odd men, excluding the ones who came in on the gliders, and I've only got 150. I had no wireless sets. I had one machine gun. I had 10 Bangalore torpedoes out of 40 to blow the gaps with. I had no anti... Wrong, I didn't know that at the time. I had no bridges in case we had to cross the anti-tank ditch. And so far as I was aware, I had no anti-tank guns, no sailors, and one doctor and very few medical people. So the decision was, do I go on with 150 or do I pack it in? But I didn't hesitate. I said, we must go on. So we moved off at 2:15, following the path which we knew so well from the photographs and which we had actually made in Newbury across the ground. And we heard a German anti-aircraft battery firing, I suppose, not more than 100 yards or 50 yards from us on our left, and some of the soldiers wanted to go for them, and I wouldn't let anybody do that. That wasn't our job. Let them get on with it. And we had made a farm halfway to the battery as our rendezvous, where Major Smith was due to come back from his job as reconnaissance party with one of the warrant officers and report, which he did. But his news was even worse than I'd feared. He told me that they had no mine detectors, no tape for marking the tapes through the minefields. And when I said, well, what happened? He said, well, Paul Greenway and another man had sat on their, had cut the wires, had crawled through the minefield, neutralizing them with their fingers, and had then sat on their backsides and dragged their heels on the ground, making a path through the minefield. And the Germans never heard any of this. It was quite extraordinary. So I was faced, therefore, with only two gaps instead of four, to put in four parties against the casements. And I had to completely replan, and I simply cut my casement assault parties right down to the maximum one could get out of 150 soldiers, and put in two parties through each gap. We had a man called Bobby de la Tour, who was a lieutenant in the Grenadier Guards, attached to the SAS, who in those days, the SAS were the pathfinders for these operations, and they went in and marked the dropping zones. And Bobby had turned up at our rendezvous, and I didn't know he was there until we got to the farm. And he was sitting on the edge of a well. I suppose the brickwork was about 3 or 4 feet above. And we were suddenly charged, and I heard bolts going and everything, and I said, no firing. And what happened was, there was about 10 cows absolutely scared stiff, and they heard us there, and they charged us in the dark. We were completely panicked. We were convinced we were being charged by Germans. When it was all over, and the cows had gone through, and thank God nobody fired, I said, where's de la Tour? He wasn't there. He had been sitting on the next to me, by the well. And a voice below me said, I'm here. And he appeared. And it transpired that this was a dry well, and this was the place where the farmers dumped everything from their outdoor loo, and he was covered in it. And did he smell. However, that was a bit of light relief for the occasion. We then moved on towards the battery, and we found that the RAF had mostly missed it because there were 100 Lancasters in support of my operation, each carrying a 1,000-pound bomb. And they'd missed the battery, but they had successfully bombed our route without knowing it, so we had to go in and out of these huge craters. We'd got about